You're listening to episode 352 of the Building Psychological Strength podcast. I'm your host, Dr. April Seifert. On this podcast, we uncover the information, tools, and techniques to turn our mind into our most valuable asset. Hey, everyone, and welcome back to this episode of the Building Psych Strength podcast. I'm Dr. April, and I'm happy that you're with me. This week we're kind of getting back to the basics. We're talking about some topics that are fundamental to the way that all of us experience life, and that is health and well-being. It's getting a ton of press lately. It's getting a ton of focus in the news recently, especially health and well-being, mental health and well-being, and the role that it's all playing on some of the decision-making that we're all engaging in, especially as the pandemic is at whatever stage that it's at right now. We can decide whether it's winding down. I don't even know how to characterize it. But it's been interesting because we all had this shift in the last couple of years, you know, sometimes away from the office, or maybe we didn't have enough time to take care of ourselves, or vice versa, that is impacting our health and well-being. And today we're going to be talking to an expert about some of the factors that help promote positive health and well-being, and then some of the things that detract from it. Today, we're going to be speaking with Laura Putnam. She is the author of the award-winning book, Workplace Wellness That Works, and she's the CEO and founder of Motion Infusion, a leading well-being provider. Her work's been covered by MSNBC, The New York Times, Fox News, ABC News, U.S. News and World Report, Entrepreneur, Business Insider, and NPR. She is a former urban public high school teacher, international community organizer, dancer, gymnast, and now a movement builder in the world of health and well-being. She's got a mission to get people and organizations in motion, and she's a frequent keynote speaker and has worked with a range of organizations from Fortune 500s to government agencies to academic institutions and nonprofits. I met Laura at a recent conference that Peak Mind attended around the art and science of health and well-being, and we just hit it off on so many aspects. One, we hit it off on this idea that sometimes we all focus individually on our own choices and on the impact that we have on our own health. And don't get me wrong, that is important. But what we neglect to realize is the strong influence that the environment, the culture, the system around us has on influencing what those choices are. We had a great conversation about that, and we talk about that in this episode. We also talk about some of the things that we can do as influencers inside our families, inside our organizations, and inside of our jobs and our companies to promote a culture of health and well-being, to make the healthy choice the easiest choice, the most fun choice, the most beautiful choice. How do we use some of the aspects of decision-making, of habit formation and change that we know influences people's behavior and put them to place to create a culture that supports, and this is Laura's way of characterizing it. I'm just going to reiterate it here because I love it, that supports all of us showing up as our best, because that's really what health and well-being is about. How do we take care of ourselves so that we can show up as our best? Because we know when we don't do that, that's completely impossible. So this episode is one that I've been so excited about because Laura is just such an expert and is such a great teacher because of her background that I know you're going to learn a lot in this episode. All right, let's dive into it with Laura Putnam. Laura, I'm so excited that you're here for this episode of the show. We met at a conference recently about, well, the art and science of health and well-being, which is such a great title for how we think about supporting ourselves and our families and our organizations. And I just love the work that you were up to, especially with this recent book. So I knew we needed to chat. So thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, April.
So you really focus, especially, you know, in this most recent work on workplace well-being, which is such a hot topic right now. And I think we're going to get into that. But you and I share a common passion for taking some of the good information, right? The really good, meaty, data-driven, evidence-based stuff that tends to be very conceptual and tends to feel to people who maybe aren't as deep into a particular field, it tends to feel like it doesn't apply to our lives, like I don't even know what to do with this. And I know you have a point of view on that and you talk about it a bit in your book. So can you talk a little bit about what that means in the context of health promotion and well-being and how people can kind of narrow that gap or bridge that gap and actually apply some of the things we're going to talk about to their lives?
Well, there are a couple of things to your point. The first is when it comes to basic health and well-being, all of us know already what to do.
Isn't that funny? We all we're just searching for the silver bullet and it's like, dang it, we already know it.
Yeah. So, you know, you'd be hard pressed to find any smoker who doesn't know that smoking's bad for them. Anyone who doesn't know that it's a good idea to eat more vegetables, get more exercise. And if all of us collectively were to do just those three things, then we as Americans could prevent up to between 70 to 90% of the major chronic diseases and conditions. Mm-hmm. As much as we all know that, less than 3% of Americans do those three simple things.
Wow. Say those three things again. You mentioned eating more fruits and vegetables, not smoking. What was the third one?
And getting enough exercise, moving. Yeah. So I know that there's a lot of conversation now from wellness to well-being, to even human being. I know something we're going to be talking about in just a moment, but just those basic three things. We all know this, and we know the other stuff as well. And on just a very basic level, we just can't seem to get ourselves to do those things. So then bringing this to the next piece, which is information is not enough. Mm-hmm. And so that's the problem that we keep coming up against, is that it's not enough to lean into the experts because the information is all out there. Mm-hmm. And the experts keep adding to the pile of information that's there. The real key is, as you bring up, is putting that information into action. And so that's why in my book, Workplace Wellness That Works, the first chapter is that if you are that health promotion person or that activator, I call myself an activator, then you're going to have to shift your mindset from expert to agent of change. Mm. And I don't want to minimize the expertise because it is so important. The science is so important. And I know that you feel very strongly, as do I, that there is a lot of misinformation that's out there. So we really need to make sure that we're delivering the right information. But even with that, even if people have the right information, all of us, with few exceptions, even the experts have a hard time translating that information into action. And so that's where we really have to look at those other pieces that go into translating information into action.
That's so good. It's so good. And I mean, we're all guilty of this, right? Like we spend so much time reading or absorbing or learning about a particular space when really the amount of information that we needed to take the first couple of steps, it's not really that much. And especially in the place of the space of health and well-being and even mental health and mental well-being, you know, we focus so much on that on this podcast. We know the things, right? We know that when we sleep well, we feel better and more resilient and more able to manage our own emotions and, you know, be in an effective relationship with other people. We know when we're eating well, we just feel better from a mental health perspective. We know meditation and mindfulness is good for us. It's so hard to do though. And it's almost one of the things that we talk about in psychology. And I think it might be the case for broader well-being. I'd be curious of your perspective, but we say, you know, there's your mind and there's its natural tendencies. Like if you leave your mind to its natural tendencies, it doesn't typically go in a great direction. It tends to go in a very anxiety provoking direction. It tends to get very negative. It tends to get very repetitive and ruminatey, which is just not a recipe for good mental well-being. It doesn't feel good experientially to be in that place. And it feels like a lot of our natural tendencies in the broader health and well-being space are that way too.
Totally. I mean, our brains are hardwired to resist change, and our brains are also hardwired to focus on the negative. I mean, that's what we have to do to survive in the short term. It just doesn't serve us well in the long term. And that's what we're really talking about with making changes around our health and well-being, closing that knowing and doing gap. Is it's not just about making changes today or even tomorrow. It's about keeping those changes today, tomorrow, the next day, the next day, the next day, the next day. It's like, how do we continue this over time? And the other piece is, you know, kind of getting back to this idea of shifting our mindset from expert to agent of change, is that as every advertiser knows, it is emotions that drive behaviors. And it's our brains that laid our logical side that later justifies those changes.
Yeah.
And so that's what an agent of change does so well. A Martin Luther King, an Oprah Winfrey, Obama, they speak first and foremost to the heart, and they really engage people on an emotional level. And then they appropriately feed the information in a way that is more digestible, that is more actionable. And so for any of us that are wanting to start a movement for others, for other organizations, for other communities, for other teams, as well as those who want to make change in our own lives, we have to think more about how we first and foremost start an emotionally driven movement of well-being and then bring in the expertise.
Mm-hmm. It's funny that you said that. In graduate school, one of my secondary lines of research, it wasn't what I did my dissertation on, it wasn't what I primarily focused on, but it was on health decision-making and how we make decisions about using sunscreen, not smoking, using condoms, eating fruits and vegetables, you know, whatever, exercising, you name it, all the things, right? The five things we know we're supposed to do. And we found exactly what you said, that, you know, at the time there were these existing models of health behavior change that said, okay, people are very rational human beings. They weigh the benefits and the barriers, or the pros and the cons. And then when the benefits outweigh the barriers or the pros outweigh the cons, they do the thing. And I'm like, no, they don't. And what we found was the missing link, the mediator in there, was affective associations or emotions. Like, do you have positive associations? Birthday cake. People have positive, warm, fuzzy associations. The one that was really fun was to study running, because you had a group of people who, it's like, running is the punishment for my sport. Like, this is what happens when I get in trouble at practice. I have to go run. And then you've got runners who are used to it being like calming and a runner's high, and they have totally different associations, completely different outcomes with the same exact behavior in the same exact circumstances. So you're exactly right. Emotion plays such an important role, and we don't think about it because it feels like this is a head problem, right? This is a logic, let's think this through information problem, but it just underscores what you said earlier. This is not information.
I mean, you know, it's interesting that kind of the piece that I bring to the field is I'm not a scientist. I'm not a researcher. What I am is I'm an educator. I'm a trained and experienced educator. Where I pull my kind of, what I bring to the field is my experience as an urban public high school teacher and educational reform leader. And so one of the things that a teacher understands very, very well is the importance of understanding not only cognitive learning objectives, but also affective learning objectives, just yes, like what you spoke about. And so now what I think about with every keynote that I deliver, every workshop that I design and deliver, every time I'm communicating in this field, I'm thinking not only what do I want people to know, I'm thinking about what do I want them to feel and what do I want them to do as a result of this keynote, of this workshop, or whatever kind of content that I bring to the field, the book that I write, what do I want people to do as a result of that? And so that, again, really speaks to that closing of the gap. It's not enough to just deliver more information. We have to think about how do we get people to actually translate that information into action.
Yeah. Your stuff is especially timely given everything we've been through in the last couple of years. I'd love to hear a little bit about where your book fits in, especially now with where we're at after the crazy experience we've all had with COVID and everything else that's come with it.
Yeah, there's so many things that kind of lessons learned. One is that there's the pandemic itself and all that has, you know, just the physical impact that COVID itself has had on us.
Right.
But then there are the pandemics within the pandemic. So there's a mental health crisis. So the toll that the pandemic took on us and all the measures that we had to take, like social distancing and masking up and double timing as caretaker and professional,
that
extracted on our mental well-being as a result of the pandemic. But then there's also things like the diabetes crisis, like that has exponentially exploded.
Yes.
During the pandemic, and that's been kind of overlooked. And so again, it's all those basic behaviors that we spoke about at the beginning that have gotten, that have not gotten better, they've gotten worse. And so those problems are still with us, this conundrum around healthy lifestyle, people know what to do, but they don't. And the real question is why? And so that, I know that's the work that you're doing. That's the work that I'm doing. And I would say that the way that I'm approaching it now is really looking at it more from an outside in perspective. Mm. What have we all kind of collectively done that has made it the healthy choice actually really the hard choice? How have we collectively designed these so-called obesogenic environments in which the environment and the culture itself is driving obesity and unhealthy lifestyle?
When I forget to ask you the question, remind me that that's the question that I want to ask you around this outside in piece. Before we go there, something that I want to highlight though is this, I've been calling it the secondary pandemic, not even around the mental health piece, because I think that's getting quite a bit of press right now, which to some extent makes me roll my eyes a little bit, because I'm like, did you not know how prolific mental health problems were and challenges were before the pandemic? Like, did you not realize how much your employees were struggling and were just holding on by the tiniest grip? And the pandemic just exposed all the weaknesses in our system. So here we are. But the
seeds were already planted, whether we're talking
100%.
About, we're talking about diabetes crisis, or we're talking about a crisis of privilege and how the systems are set up where some people have much, 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 much easier access to making the healthy choice compared to others. And all of these issues were only accelerated and further exposed by the pandemic.
Yeah. The secondary pandemic that you mentioned that I want to highlight to folks a bit more. My husband's an ER physician and he sees this every single day. He's going to go into work today to this evening and see it. It's people who for 2 years, for reasons, right? We said, don't leave your home, don't go anywhere, especially if you went to a medical facility, there's people with COVID there. So, and in the beginning, we didn't know. Now, even though we can, I think we've all kind of, I mean, habits happen and we've gotten into habits that aren't supporting our health and well-being, but truly at least in our area, the emergency departments are completely overloaded and inundated. You cannot get in, 7-hour waits, no seating in the waiting room anywhere. And it's not COVID. It's just exacerbated chronic conditions because we as a, when we talk about population health, we as a population for a long time haven't been able to do some of the things, not all, some of the things that would support and help keep those chronic conditions under control. And then we kind of fell out of the habit of knowing, you know, of having it be part of our lives. So I think that's an important one to underscore for folks, because if you haven't set foot in an emergency department recently, it would be shocking if you walked in right now and saw what you saw.
Well, and I think that those emergency rooms or those urban public high schools where I taught is that there are two Americas.
Yes.
There's a growing division between the haves and the have-nots. We have the highest level of income inequality that we have had since the late 1800s. Mm-hmm. We are today where we were in the Gilded Age. And so in an area where I live in the Bay Area, we have the highest concentration of billionaires. And at the same time, we have an explosion in homelessness. Yeah. And so these two realities are happening. And so during the pandemic, for some people, they profited wildly during the pandemic. For some people who were non-essential workers, they got more time with their family. They got more time in nature. They got more time to mm-hmm. kind of manage their own time. And then for others, it was exactly the opposite experience. So that's something that we really have to look at as a society, is that, are we going to continue with this kind of approach? Each person is on their own. Each person has to take responsibility for themselves and their family. Or are we going to instead think more about all of us in this together? And we think more about how my health and well-being matters to you and yours matters to me. And the only way forward is together.
And you just made the point that I was referencing earlier around, make me ask you this question. Because in the United States, we're very individualistic. Right? Like as a culture, we're very individualistic. And that just means I believe that my outcomes are mine to manage. I believe that my choices are mine to make. We sort of put ourselves on that island. But where this doesn't help us is when, I'm just going to say systemic as just a very umbrella word. When systemically, it almost preys on that individualistic nature that we all have to say, no. It isn't that we've made unhealthy food more available, more or less expensive, more prolific than healthy food. That isn't it. It's that you are making bad choices. It isn't that, you know, there's so many examples that we can give of this just across the board, but I'd love to hear some of the thinking you've done around more systemically or societally, because I think people blame themselves. Like we hear, like there's so much shame and blame around, like, why can't I, why is this so hard? We see it as a default or a deficit of ourselves when we don't realize how much we're influenced by the environment and the culture around us.
Yeah. I mean, just as people like Raj Chetty, who is a leading economist, has been looking at the state of the American dream and the extent to which some people have easy access to it and others don't. Yeah. The same is true when it comes to the pursuit of our health and well-being. And so that's why I've been really talking about and thinking about this idea of wellness privilege. Do you have wellness privilege? So an analogy is to think of two escalators, an up escalator and a down escalator. Some of us are lucky enough where the systems are benefiting us. So we are effectively on an up escalator. Mm-hmm. And sure, we can go up or down it through our quote personal choice. But if you're lucky enough to be on an up escalator, where the systems are serving you. So for example, you have the privilege of being able to come to work and being able to show up as your full authentic self, as opposed yeah. to having to code switch, for example, when you come to work. Or yep. you have the privilege of living in a community where you have easy access to green space, for example. Or you have the privilege of work where you are able to take breaks. If you're working in a call center, you're not going to be able to take breaks when you need to. And instead, somebody else is making that decision for you. So some of us are lucky enough to be on that up escalator. We have access to healthy, to excellent schools for ourselves, for our children. We have access to good healthcare. We have access to transportation. We have access to safe neighborhoods, healthy places to go. And others of us are on a down escalator. So if you're on that down escalator, sure, you can still go up it. But if you stop for even a moment, you are going down. So yeah. the question that we need to begin asking ourselves is, am I healthier, more enabled to become my best self because of where I live and because of the systems within my community, either benefiting me or working against me, or less so? Am I more enabled to become my best self because of the places I go, where I go to school, where I work, or less so? Am I more enabled to become my best self or less so because of the boss that I work for, because of the team that I'm on, or less so? And then within that, it's like, okay, given these concentric circles of cultural and environmental influence, how do I become my best self? So we just have to kind of reframe that personal responsibility mantra and understand that we are arguably more creatures of culture than we are creatures of habit. And so we have to call out the extent to which our concentric circles of cultural and environmental influence are actually pushing us toward the healthy choice, or in fact, if they are pushing us away from them. And so we're effectively like salmon having to swim upstream. So just by calling out those currents of influence, or the extent to which we're on the up escalator or the down escalator, can help us to then better navigate them.
That's so good. And you see people making changes right now in some of those circles, the concentric circles that you mentioned. I mean, there's a lot more to it than just this issue, but as people are leaving jobs and there's this mass sort of reshuffling of where people work, some of the things that people are saying are, I can't work those hours anymore. I can't give up so much for this job anymore because it isn't supporting your health and well-being. So I feel like people are starting to see that the environment that they were in and then were taken out of and now are threatening to go back to, it's a cultural environmental thing. It's so much more than just, you know, it isn't just the office that's a physical location. That's just geography. It's so much more than that around the lifestyle that I think people aren't as willing to go back to if it wasn't one that supported, and mental health is a big one right now that didn't support their mental health and well-being.
Totally. I mean, it's like the water that you're swimming in. Is it,
yeah.
Is it healthy or is it unhealthy? And so, you know, talking about things like mental health, we know, for example, that the root causes of burnout in the workplace, the leading root causes have nothing to do with the individual and everything to do with the workplace itself. So it's things like toxicity tolerated, or it's things like work overload, or it's things like unreasonable time pressure, or it's things like lack of transparency, lack of support and communication from one's manager, lack of perceived organizational support. Those are the kinds of key drivers, and those are of burnout, and those are the structural issues that organizations have to choose. Are we going to actually identify those, take a hard look at those, or are we going to continue to point fingers at the individual and blame them for being stressed out, blame them for being burned out, when we know that it's a much bigger picture?
Yeah. What trends are you seeing in workplace wellness these days around, I feel like things have changed so much. So I'm curious what you're seeing now, as opposed to maybe what we may have seen 5 years ago, 10 years ago.
Yeah. Well, first of all, you know, just as we've talked about, mental health has taken center stage for sure. Yeah. There's so much of an awakening around mental health. And yes, as you said, we know, for example, that rates of suicide have been increasing for a long time. Yeah. This is not new. All of these only exacerbated by the pandemic, but it's really, we're able to see this more. So I think that there's much more of a willingness to talk more openly and to start to destigmatize conversations around mental health in the workplace. The second big one being, I'm seeing a transition from wellness in the classic sense, eat your vegetables, get exercise, don't smoke, as we've talked about, to well-being, to these multiple dimensions of well-being. It's not just physical, it's emotional, it's social, it's financial, it's career, it's community. But now really a conversation around human being. Mm. What are the deepest human needs that we are all wired to need? We all need autonomy. We don't want to be told what to do. We want flexibility in how we work, where we work, when we work. These are things that we all need. We all want to be in connection with one another. We all want to feel like that we matter. Then another big trend that I'm seeing is just, you know, this, we're asking the question, do you have wellness privilege? And as I've talked about before, and really understanding those systems at play, it's not just an individual issue, it's also a systemic one. And then finally, that, you know, well-being is here to stay. I mean, certainly that is a silver lining from this, is that people are voting with their feet. They want well-being in the time of the Great Resignation. They're saying, I want well-being in this more human being kind of sense. And organizations are being forced to respond to that and to provide well-being in a holistic, meaningful way, not just a Band-Aid approach with a steps challenge that has, that's about collecting points and checking the box, as opposed to really enabling people to become their best selves.
I love that. I love your point about human being. It's funny. I've thought about, you know, everybody has their email signature. I've thought about putting, and I don't have them complete yet, or they would be on my email signatures, but what my rules are for meetings, and they are all things around that. You're a human being who needs to eat once in a while. I literally cannot think of a single person, professionally, personally, anything like that, that I would meet with, minus maybe a podcast interview where audio is important and it's going to be recorded and used. But minus that, where if you are hungry, get a sandwich, or get, like, you can eat on any meeting with me, but that has not been the case. Like, the number, I think I looked it up at one point, it was like 60% of knowledge workers regularly skip lunch or eat through their lunch or work through their lunch on a regular basis. And that's just one aspect, right? Like, if stress is keeping us up, we're not sleeping, we're in an office environment with no ability to rest back to back with meetings all day, we're not resting or getting any rejuvenation during the day, we're not eating. I mean, maybe we drink some water during the day, but like the basics. And then you get into other things like autonomy and all of that. And we really had been very robotic, and this focus on optimization of our workforce. It's funny, I sat in a round table of chief human resources officers at one point. And the question they kept asking was, how do we get more out of our people? And I'm like, you cannot squeeze people anymore. At some point, you have squeezed them to the point where they're like, I can't do this anymore. And we're starting to see that now. And so I just love that you made the point of human being, because we've neglected it for so long. And I think people are just saying enough, like, I just can't anymore.
Yeah, we can't get around the fact that we're all human beings. And that's how I open up Workplace Wellness That Works, is just, you know, well-being, really what it is about enabling ourselves and others to be a human being. So we are born to move, but we're told to sit. So we've got this kind of what we need as human beings versus what our culture drives us toward. We are born to eat whole foods. We're born to eat when we're hungry, but we're told to always be on. we're, you know, born to take breaks, but we're told to always be on. We're the unhealthy choice, the fast food, the processed foods are so much easier to access. We're told that we can't take a lunch. All these kinds of things, these mismatches are really are the key drivers. We have to collectively kind of do a better job of addressing those mismatches. And one of the best ways that we can in the workplace is to engage those key influencers. And in the workplace, it's the manager.
Yeah.
Every manager, whether or not wellness or well-being or human being is part of their job description, they have everything to do with the extent to which their team members are either engaging with their well-being or the extent to which they are not. And according to longstanding research from Gallup, the manager alone likely accounts for up to 70% of the variance of their team members' engagement, both with their work as well as their well-being. And so this is why so much of my work is really concentrated on activating those managers to become multipliers of well-being for their team by doing it themselves. So leading by example, it's not about being perfect, it's about making the effort. Talking about well-being in a human way, and then finally creating some team-based systems to normalize it within the context of the team.
That's so good. And I know we talked about this a little bit before we hit the record button, but I would urge people to think broadly about what you mean by manager, because if you play that sort of key glue role in your family, that puts you right in that seat. I mean, any of those concentric circles you spoke about, if you play an influential role in any of them, you have the opportunity to change the way that that environment and that culture functions in the direction of better well-being and more supportive of human beings and their needs.
It's absolutely true. And so we know that there's kind of this outside in effect of these concentric circles of cultural and environmental influence. And then there's this kind of what the inside out, where what I do not only influences me for better or for worse, but just because of the social contagion effect, my behaviors travel through a social network. And so I positively or negatively impact those around me. And on top of that, if I happen to hold a position of influence within that circle, if you will, then I have even more of an impact on people within my social network. So it's really interesting within the family unit. Is it the parent who is the key influencer? Or in some cases, is it actually the children who hold more influence? Or for example, the power of peer influence. We know that as kids get older, their parents hold less and less influence, and it's their peers who hold more influence. So I absolutely agree with you about really identifying kind of those larger systemic forces, but also identifying those key influencers within these little pockets that can have an outsized influence on those around them.
Yeah. You talk about a number of different ways in the book that people can do that. So practical, tactical things that people can do. Two that I love that I want to call out. You talk about nudges and cues, the different, what they are, the differences between them. Can you talk a little bit about nudges and cues? Because this relates so nicely to some of the other, you know, topics that we've talked about on the podcast. And is, I mean, for something seemingly so small, they have such a huge impact. So I'd love it if you could dive in there a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, so when I talk about how do we get workplace wellness to work, take this really good idea, which is to leverage every workplace to promote better health and well-being. The biggest thing that I see is that we can take more of this outside-in approach and think less about what the individual should be doing differently and more about how do we simply optimize the environment and the culture so that health and well-being, the pursuit of health and well-being, becomes easier and more normal. Mm-hmm. So nudges are environmental prompts that drive us toward the healthy choice. So bringing healthy food to every meeting, for example, every manager can do that if you're in person. But also cues are cultural prompts that make it normal. So what are some simple rituals of well-being, like kicking off a meeting with naming three good things that help everybody to become a little bit more resilient, a little bit more optimistic? But thinking that more, how do we do this as a team as opposed to just relying upon individuals to do it for themselves? So thinking less about self-care, thinking more about team care. And then to your point, we can also do this as individuals, kind of acting as architects within our own space that we operate within. So if I want to be more active, for example, then maybe I should just set out my walking shoes, have my clothes all ready to go so that it requires a little less effort for me to get myself out the door.
Mm-hmm. Or it's so good.
Or how might I like do a little refrigerator architecture where I get the healthy options. I wash the veggies, I cut them up, put them in glass containers so that when I open the refrigerator, it's like there's zero effort in going and grabbing a carrot stick because it's already washed. It's right there in plain sight for me. So I'm more likely to actually eat it.
I love that. And people, you know, people think it's sort of cheesy when you see some of these, like you see videos on TikTok all the time of people making their fridge look beautiful and all of this stuff. But we have to recognize the psychological role that that has on our decision-making. We are human beings. At the bottom line, things that are easy are more likely to be done. Things that are fun are more likely to be done. Things that are good-looking are more likely, you know, like we're drawn to things that are easy, fun, good-looking. So if we can make it just sort of a default, and it's funny because so much of what we teach in Peak Mind, we're taking the just general rails that your mind runs on. Like, our mind likes to create shortcuts. Great. Cool. If you let it do its own thing, it's going to create a whole bunch of shortcuts that a bunch of them won't serve you very well. But you can also use that same mechanism to get your mind to create a new shortcut. And what you're talking about here is using our own just natural tendencies for good rather than unhealthy? I don't want to say evil. Maybe not evil, but for unhealthy. Are there other suggestions you have for people who are in influential roles that they might help support that outer, the systemic, the I guess, scaffolding that makes it more likely for us to have healthy lifestyles?
Well, another chapter in the book is uncover the hidden factors. That is, take a dive and take a look at your culture. Is the larger culture across the organization one that is likely to support this, the pursuit of well-being, or is it actually undermining it? So you have these wellness programs that are giving that signaling and messaging one thing that often are in complete contradiction to what you're trying to promote in your wellness programs. And also doing that, team by team. What's the kind of cultural norm within our team? But just to call that out and to start to take a hard look at the culture and assess it. One of my favorite ways of doing this is actually with images. And I do this in the context of workshops, particularly with managers and leaders. And so I have a series of different images. So, positive images like holding hands or light through the trees. And then more negative ones like, Sherpas carrying heavy backpacks or a horse kicking the other one in the face. And I ask these managers and leaders the questions, okay, if you were to ask the average employee here in your organization to identify the image that best depicts their day-to-day experience when they are at work, which one would they pick? Are they going to pick the holding hands or are they going to pick the horse kicking the other one in the face? And then think about that for your team. Think about that for you personally. And then where would you like to be as an individual, as a team, and as an organization? So that is that clarity, I think, is so important. And then the other piece that I would offer, something else that I talk about in the book, is starting with what's right. I feel like that so much in the field of health and well-being is all around, let's identify all the things that you're doing wrong, make you feel really badly, and then we're going to provide some incentives here and make it kind of, we try to make it fun when in fact we've depleted people from the start. So how might we help celebrate what people are doing right first, build on that, and then engage people in their well-being?
This is so good. There's so much more that we could talk about. There's so much more under the covers, and there's so much in your book that I think people need to be aware of. Can you tell people a bit about where they can find out more about you, where they can find out more about your book, especially if you are one of those people who play an influential role in one of those, spheres that we talked about? I think you would really benefit from this information. So tell us where we can find out more.
So Workplace Wellness That Works, the book, is available through any of the major distributors. So you can go on Amazon. It's there. Wellable is actually running a book club right now with it.
That's awesome.
So there's that. You can go to motioninfusion.com. There's lots of free resources there that you can download. So for example, A Manager's Guide to Creating an Oasis of Well-Being or Me at My Best Guide is downloadable. You can use that. I'm very active on social media. So you can find me on LinkedIn. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. And then you can also go to lauraputnam.com, LauraPutnam. And I have tons of interviews that I've done, lots of podcast interviews like these, but also television interviews, radio interviews. I write prolifically. So there's lots of articles that I've written and regularly am interviewed for other print media as well. So there's lots of ways that you can find me.
I love it. It's such an important topic right now. And it's important for us to, I know this is where we started this conversation, but it feels like the right way to circle back to it. The gap between the conceptual and the information versus what actually happens in our lives, we need to focus on ways to close that gap or bridge that gap, whatever the metaphor you want to use is, because ultimately, people's their health and well-being, I mean, that is like number one. If you don't have that, everything else is so much more difficult or impossible in your life. So I appreciate the work that you're doing to help bridge that gap. It's something that I'm passionate about as well. And I just appreciate you being here and sharing this with us.
You know, a couple of closing thoughts.
Yeah.
One is, to your point, there's a Chinese proverb, ask a healthy man what he wishes for, and he'll tell you 1,000 wishes. Ask an unhealthy man what he wishes for, and he will tell you just one.
Wow.
So health and well-being so often is something that we take for granted. And in fact, and then when we lose it, it's the one thing that we want more than anything else. So how can we all take measures so that it's not too late and it's something that we can optimize now, for lack of a better word? And more importantly, how can we do this together so that it's not such a heavy load for every individual? And how can we really recognize that there really is no me without you, and the only way forward is together?
So good. That was perfect. Laura, I'm so appreciative for you being here. And I'm so glad that we had a chance to meet at this conference recently. We both share just a passion for helping people experientially live life in a way that is full and vibrant and feels good. And so much of the work that you do helps with that. So thank you so much.
Thank you, April.
All right, friends, I have a few additional resources for you in addition to the link where you can grab Laura's book. So hang with me for one more second and I'll be right back with a few more goodies before we close this episode out. All right. I hope you enjoyed that interview with Laura Putnam about how we can support our health and well-being and the health and well-being of others around us, whether that means supporting a culture of health and well-being in your workplace, in another organization that you're part of, or even within your own family or personal culture. I hope all of the information that she shared and the practical tips are helpful in helping you to make meaningful changes in your own health and well-being. As somebody who has a chronic condition, I've lived with multiple sclerosis for almost 30 years. I can definitely tell you that her point about wishing to have your health and well-being there when it's been taken away, there's so much truth to that. So you're worth it. You are worth taking care of. And I hope this episode helped you do that. A few additional resources. One, I've linked to Laura's book, Workplace Wellness That Works, down below in the additional resources section. So if you're interested in that book, if you are a person inside an organization that supports workplace wellness, please check that book out because there is so much in it that draws from the field of psychology, draws from the field of decision making to help support your teams to make better decisions and better support their wellness. The second thing that I wanted to talk about is a podcast episode. It was episode 275. It's called The Link Between Self-Compassion and Self-Care. What made me think about this episode was when Laura talked about how health and well-being is really just supporting yourself to be your best. And that's the way that we talk about self-care a little bit. It's just asking yourself the question, what do I need right now? And sometimes that answer is, I need a nap. Sometimes that answer is, I need to go for a walk. Sometimes that answer is, I need to eat or drink a glass of water or sleep, go to bed early tonight. Asking yourself, what do I need? And then fulfilling that need is the most basic, most fundamental act of self-care. But in order to do that, sometimes there's a barrier there that we don't realize. And that barrier can be the critical nature that the critical relationship that we have with ourselves. Sometimes we can feel like we're not deserving, like we aren't as big of a priority as other people are. And self-compassion, which is the other half of that episode, the link between self-compassion and self-care. Self-compassion can help us develop that better, more effective, more deep relationship, more trusting relationship with ourselves so that we remove that barrier and are in a much better position to support ourselves and care for ourselves. So wanted to call that out, episode 275, the link between self-compassion and self-care. The last one that I want to call out is an episode called Develop Better Habits in 2022. This is episode 325. Here we're doing a great job of breaking down the habit change literature. And so if you are a person who wants to make changes for yourself, we really draw on a lot of the similar things that Laura talked about in this episode and that she mentions in her book. So if you want to get maybe just a quick primer on that literature, it's a really good episode to start with because it's very practical and talks you through how to make these changes in your own life. So episode 325, Develop Better Habits in 2022. It's just named that because I released it toward the end of the year. It will work at any point in time if you put it into practice. Thank you guys so much for being with me each and every week. It's funny, I've been talking to some people about growing the podcast and doing some work on the back end. And every single time, you guys are the people that I'm thinking about. I'm thinking about this audience, how I can serve you more, how I can continue to serve you. This isn't really my job. And so doing this is truly a passion project of wanting to get good information and good experts out there. So I'm likely to be reaching out in the coming few weeks with a bit of an ask. I think I'm going to run a survey of the audience of this podcast to just understand a little bit about what you might want out of this podcast, who I might reach out to try to get as a guest. So start thinking about that. Start thinking about what you might want me to do on this podcast, topics you want me to cover, etc. Because I'm here for you. I'm here to support you. That's why we exist. That's why the podcast exists. So I'm so appreciative of you. And finally, let's remember that time is the most non-renewable resource on the planet, and I'm grateful to each and every one of you who chose to spend some of your precious time with me today. I'm Dr. April Seifert, and I'll see you next week.